we're scrutinizing all our investments, and Point Thompson Unit does not compete in our portfolio with other projects.
ConocoPhillips has given up its stake in the Point Thompson gas field. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a legislative reporter accuses a state senator of slapping him inside a Capitol stairwell.
Yeah, he slapped me. That was interesting.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
State Representative David Eastman says some Alaskans are glad to become pregnant so they can have a Medicaid-funded trip to Anchorage or Seattle to have an abortion. Eastman didn't provide evidence for this, but says he has been told this by friends and acquaintances. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Representative Eastman says Medicaid funding for travel for health care provides an incentive to become pregnant and have an abortion.
We've created an incentive structure where people are now incented to carry their pregnancy out longer than they would otherwise, and then take part in that when they wouldn't otherwise be doing it.
Do you have any evidence that that's actually occurred?
I certainly know of specific instances where it's occurred.
Could you talk about that?
Well, I won't be giving you the names of the people involved, but yeah, I can think of a case that was brought to our attention earlier this session where you had a family who was, you know, very glad to hear that their abortion had gone beyond a certain point because, you know, they were going to be heading to Seattle.
The first-term Republican from Wasilla made similar comments to the Associated Press. He says many of his constituents want to eliminate Medicaid funding for abortion.
We have individuals who are in villages and, you know, are glad to be pregnant so that they can have an abortion because there's a free trip to Anchorage involved.
Katie Rogers is the spokeswoman for Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands.
That is a ludicrous and despicable statement.
Planned Parenthood has sued the state over restrictions that prevent second trimester abortions from being performed in Alaska.
The process for a woman to get to Seattle to access reproductive health care, a full range of reproductive health care, is incredibly challenging.
Rogers says Eastman would never know the difficulty of traveling for an abortion.
To even suggest that women are benefiting off the very restrictions that the state has put in place as it relates to second trimester abortions, it is a new low, even for Representative Eastman.
Eastman also says that some women who fly to Anchorage for abortions but who change their minds are unable to fly home because Medicaid won't pay for it.
Since they're not going to complete the abortion at that point, they've decided not to, there really is no way for them to get home.
State Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson was traveling and couldn't comment Wednesday on the issue. Eastman made his remarks after working to amend a resolution to proclaim next April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month and Child Abuse Prevention Month. Eastman's amendment inserted a statement that abortion is the ultimate form of child abuse. It's not clear whether the resolution will receive a vote in the House. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The U.S. House plans to vote Thursday on a Republican bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, and Alaska Congressman Don Young isn't declaring a position. His office says Young has no new comments on the subject. Senator Lisa Murkowski wasn't so reticent today.
I have real hardship with the direction that I'm seeing the House go.
Murkowski says she hasn't followed every turn in the negotiations, but she doesn't like that the bill would allow insurance companies in some states to charge more for people with pre-existing conditions.
I watched the president's interview this weekend where he basically said, no, don't worry, pre-existing is covered. Well, it is and it isn't.
The bill President Trump negotiated with House Republicans would let states opt out of the requirement that insurers charge people of the same age the same premium, regardless of their medical status. Murkowski says that's the wrong feature of the Affordable Care Act to ditch.
I talk to Alaskans about the things that they care about. The first thing that is out of their mouth is, oh, I like the pre-existing condition part.
A new version of the bill would add $8 billion over 5 years to lower costs for people who are riskiest to insure. Murkowski says she's not sure that's the right approach. It's unclear if the House will vote on it before Friday when members depart for a 10-day recess. ConocoPhillips has confirmed it's giving up its small stake in the Point Thompson Field on the North Slope. The move has some observers wondering if it's a bad sign for the state's effort to build a massive natural gas line. Point Thompson is one of the state's newest oil and gas projects. It's about 60 miles east of Prudhoe Bay and started producing last year. Exxon operates the project, and BP is the other major owner. Conoco only had about a 5% interest in the field. Conoco spokeswoman Natalie Lohman says the company wants to focus more on its core projects.
I think everyone's aware that the oil price is in a slump right now, and so in this current oil price environment, we're scrutinizing all our investments, and Point Thompson Unit does not compete in our portfolio with other projects.
Today, Point Thompson is producing a liquid called natural gas condensate, but the field's real potential is its massive natural gas reserves. That gas can't be sold until a gas pipeline is built to carry it from the North Slope to market. The state of Alaska recently took over leadership of the gas line project from ConocoBP and Exxon. It aims to start construction in 2019, but amidst low natural gas prices, the project faces big financial challenges. Lohman says giving up a stake in Point Thompson doesn't mean Conoco doesn't support the gas line.
This decision has no reflection on our support for a state-led project to monetize North Slope gas. We have been and are still willing to make our gas available for sale at the wellhead.
But Kenai Peninsula Borough oil and gas advisor Larry Pursley says Conoco's decision to walk away from Point Thompson doesn't bode well for the project.
It confirms to me the gas line is not coming anytime soon, or you would have held on to it because then Point Thompson could be a moneymaker.
However, a spokeswoman for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation said as long as the companies are willing to sell gas, the state isn't concerned about Conoco's decision on Point Thompson. In a call with investors yesterday, Conoco reported it earned $99 million in Alaska in the first quarter of 2017. Lohman says during that period, the company paid about $250 million in taxes to the state. Globally, Conoco reported a first quarter loss of $19 million, an improvement from the first quarter of last year when the company lost $1.2 billion amid crashing oil prices. The Alaska Dispatch News is reporting one of its reporters was slapped by a state senator. According to an article put up today, the event happened Tuesday in Juneau. Mat-Su Valley Republican David Wilson is alleged to have lightly hit Capitol reporter Nathaniel Herz in a stairwell. Herz recently wrote about a piece of legislation the freshman senator from Wasilla had introduced. At the time, Herz had his iPhone out recording audio.
What do you think? Was that reasonable?
Reasonable.
Fair.
Fair.
In the recording, Wilson can be heard taking a long pause after being asked if he thought the article was fair, and then...
There we go.
As Wilson walks away, Herz is heard telling another nearby senator.
Yeah, he slapped me. That was interesting.
Herz wasn't hurt in the incident, but did file a report with the Juneau Police Department. He declined to comment and pointed to the paper's own coverage of the incident. The ADN's news editor, David Hewlin, is quoted in the paper as saying, "It's not okay for a legislator to strike anyone." Senator Wilson's office says it has no comment on what happened. A spokesperson for the Senate majority wrote in an email that the Senate expects professional conduct from all its members and won't comment until all the facts in the situation are understood. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 30 years later, researchers are just beginning to understand how the Exxon Valdez oil spill affected wildlife.
As they're digging in the sediment to pull out clams and other prey, there's a risk that they would dig into a pocket of oil.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
As expected, environmental groups have filed a lawsuit over an order President Trump signed last week to reverse a ban on Arctic offshore oil and gas leasing. Late last year, then-President Obama withdrew most Arctic waters from the possibility of leasing for an indefinite period of time. The law Obama used, Section 12A of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, doesn't say anything about how a president can undo a withdrawal of this kind. The Wilderness Society, League of Conservation Voters, and eight other groups claim in their suit the protection was permanent, and President Trump doesn't have the authority to reverse it. The Arctic Energy Center issued a counter-argument in a press statement. The industry lobby says there's no precedent for a permanent ban of the kind Obama imposed, and the group says nothing in the law bars a later president from reversing it. The lawsuit is filed in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. It does not mention a separate 12A withdrawal Trump reversed for the Bering Sea. The White House wanted to cut Sea Grant's funding for the remainder of this fiscal year. If the request had been approved, several projects in Alaska would have ended as early as this summer. Sea Grant helps coastal communities with fisheries and climate change research. Despite President Donald Trump's request, Congress released a bipartisan spending bill on Monday that will allow Sea Grant to continue for the time being. Sunny Rice from Alaska Sea Grant in Petersburg says that's good news.
It's going to allow us to keep doing the things, you know, at least through the end of September that we had been planning on. I feel like it's like a quarter of a sigh of relief because I think the big effort is going to be for the full budget.
President Trump's blueprint budget asks Congress to consider eliminating Sea Grant's funding for next year, too. Since the president made the announcement in March, Alaska's congressional delegation has shown support for Sea Grant, saying the program is a good return on investment. Sea Grant helps fund research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Congress is expected to approve a budget for next fiscal year by October. It looks like Alaska's first retail marijuana store is likely to stay open. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, Ballot Proposition 1, which would have banned the sales and cultivation of marijuana within Valdez city limits, is failing following preliminary results from last night's municipal election.
Opponents of Proposition 1 were happy after the preliminary results from Tuesday night's Valdez municipal election were announced. 835 voters said no to Prop 1, while only 286 voted yes. That means retail stores and cultivators will continue to do business within city limits. At an election party at the local bar, the boardroom, owners and staff of Herbal Outfitters breathed a little easier after months of campaigning against Prop 1. The store's general manager, Derek Morris, says he can sleep better knowing that he still has a job.
We were fearful. When your head's on the chopping block, you don't know, and we didn't want to let down anybody. But to see the numbers come in, you can't put it into words. And right now, just being part of it is over the moon excitement for not only us, but for this industry in Alaska for it to move forward. This shows that we're no longer the minority, we are the majority.
Last October, Herbal Outfitters became the first retail marijuana store to open in the state. The store was still under construction when a local group successfully petitioned for Prop 1 to be on this year's ballot. Some members of the group felt the store would have a negative impact on the community, especially with minors. Herbal Outfitters owner Rick Ballou, who invested $1 million into the store, extended his hand to proponents of Prop 1.
They can rest assured that Herbal Outfitters is willing to work with them at any time, and we are going to keep it out of the hands of kids under 21. We want them to know that.
If Prop 1 had passed, Herbal Outfitters would have had 90 days to close the stores. Retail sales and cultivation of marijuana could only be sold 10 miles outside city limits. Final election results will be certified at Wednesday's Valdez City Council meeting. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
It's day two of Snake Watch. That's what one Mat-Su borough official is calling an ongoing situation with an enormous pet python that's still at large. Residents in the West Mallard Lane area are advised to keep a close eye on small pets and children. The snake's owner is David Hyde, who says he's gone door to door warning neighbors, and with good reason. The 17-foot, 100-pound Burmese python named Sam is capable of eating two 25-pound rabbits in one meal.
They're taking it more seriously as a public safety issue than they are as a lost pet. Most of them don't like snakes, just flat out, and they can't understand why anybody would have one, and they would just as soon he died in the woods somewhere.
Hyde says he first got Sam 9 years ago as a rescue pet. Now he's worried.
Yeah, a little. He's probably either found a comfortable, safe-feeling spot, and he's okay, or he's frozen to death. And there's not a whole bunch I can do about either one because there's about 2 million places he could hide.
Anyone who sees a 17-foot yellow and white python is asked to call 911. The National Transportation Safety Board says a 75-year-old pilot killed last year in a crash in Anchorage was impaired by carbon monoxide. Investigator Clint Johnson, in a report released Monday, says a float plane piloted by James Hefty had a severely degraded and damaged muffler can assembly. That likely allowed carbon monoxide to enter the cockpit before Hefty crashed September 16th in an Anchorage residential neighborhood. Toxicological examination of his blood showed a 48% level of carbamoxyhemoglobin formed when carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin. Levels from 10 to 20% can cause confusion and impair judgment. Witnesses told investigators the low-flying airplane made two 360-degree right turns at high power before hitting a tree and crashing. Family member says such maneuvers would have been highly unusual for Hefty. When the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound in 1989, the immediate impacts were fairly obvious. Researchers estimate that hundreds of thousands of seabirds and thousands of sea otters died within months. But in the years that followed, some populations bounced back quickly, while others may never recover. Now, nearly three decades later, researchers are starting to understand why. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Okay, you might want to cover your ears for a minute. I'm going to play you some tape from 28 years ago. That's the sound of sea otters being unloaded from a helicopter at the Anchorage Airport in 1989 after being rescued from Prince William Sound.
That noise is sea otter pups that are in distress. So yeah, it's pretty distinctive. Screeching sound that you wouldn't expect to come from such a cuddly-looking animal.
Dan Essler is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage. He started studying the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez in 1994, and he definitely didn't expect he'd still be studying it all these years later, because biologists didn't think it would take that long for wildlife to recover.
Even back in 94, there was some surprised about the evidence that some species weren't fully recovered already. And this was 5 years after the spill. So even that seemed like it was a long duration.
Little did they know. Sea otters weren't declared recovered until 2014. That's 25 years after the spill. But other species did much better. So Essler and his team asked, why? Why did some species bounce right back while others still haven't recovered? They found that some wildlife kept running into oil years after the spill. That oil lingered in beach sediment, where animals like sea otters hunt for food.
As they're digging in the sediment to pull out clams and other prey, there's a risk that they would dig into a pocket of oil.
Other species didn't have that problem. Bald eagles, for instance. Once the initial spill had dispersed, eagles weren't that likely to encounter oil again. And eagles can reproduce pretty quickly. But for species that take longer to reproduce, the spill was devastating. Two populations of killer whales still haven't recovered.
And it's not that they're still being exposed to oil. It's that because of the life history of these animals, it's almost impossible for them to have recovered, in a short time frame.
Or even a long one. One population may never recover. The takeaway, Essler says, is there's no such thing as a single response to an oil spill. Some species can shake it off. For others, a spill can have ripple effects for generations. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
In Wrangell, recycling isn't as simple as wheeling a plastic container out to the curb each week. That service doesn't exist in most communities in southeast Alaska, not to mention trying to get rid of large items like old TVs, computers, and printers. In order to prevent these items from ending up in a landfill, they need to be sorted by hand and shipped off the island. Aaron Bolton accompanied Wrangell's local tribe as members collected the town's broken electronics and has this story.
Early on a Saturday morning, Kim Wickman is sorting through a bin full of old cell phones, chargers, and cords. Wickman works for the Wrangell Cooperative Association and has been building the tribe's existing recycling efforts since coming on board last year. She even brings household batteries dropped off at her office on personal trips to recycle. But getting rid of large electronics is a whole other problem.
I spend a lot of time out the road on the logging roads, and you find broken computer towers because people don't know what to do with them. They don't want their data heading out there to somewhere where somebody could steal information. So they take them out and they shoot them, or maybe run over them, and that's not the best option for them. So they need another option.
As the morning rolls on, three pallets are quickly stacking up. Someone drops off a huge sack, easily weighing more than 150 pounds, full of industrial cords. But most people are just cleaning out their closet. Kay Larson unloads several items out of her truck.
This is an external hard drive, but it's old and dead, and a couple of computers that ran out on me, and a printer, camera.
And so how long have you been holding on to some of this stuff?
Probably about 17 years, some of it. And I'm just thrilled to have this event here. I was like, yeah, I started house cleaning in order to get my things ready for this.
Adam Klahach brought in a couple of old laptops. If this event didn't come along, Klahach explains he wouldn't have known what to do with them.
Eventually, I would have got sick of seeing it on the shelf and probably just thrown it in with the rest of the trash. And I'm glad it isn't just ending up in a waste landfill. So,
all of the items are being collected by Total Reclaim, a Seattle-based electronic recycler. Riley Kaczynski has worked with the company's Alaska branch for about 10 years. He's already starting to break things down, snapping a paper tray off a printer stacked on several others. Items are separated into categories based on the components inside them and their value.
So anything that we accept electronic-wise, it's a balancing act between what we can get on the backside after it's broken down and sorted versus how much it costs us to process it, to basically have our guys either break it down by hand or have it go through our processing equipment and separate out the plastics, the metals, the circuitry, and in the case of the monitors, the clean glass versus the leaded glass.
Kaczynski travels around Alaska, providing education and outreach to rural communities who may not know how to get an event like this going. He started working in Southeast 6 years ago, and Total Reclaim now collects about 400,000 pounds of e-waste in the region every year. Total Reclaim charges to take most items, but gladly collects computers for free, which contain the most precious metals.
Again, you know, like one computer isn't, you can't go take it to McDonald's and get a Big Mac with it, but if you have, you know, hundreds and thousands of computers that you're processing, you can start building big lots of circuitry where we do get some good value out of it.
Most items will either be broken down by hand or literally smashed and sorted. Pieces will be sent to downstream recyclers as far as Japan and Europe, where metals and plastics will be broken down and reintroduced into the manufacturing market. The Wrangell Cooperative Association plans to hold a collection event annually and is picking up the tab this year. Wickman hopes it entices people to not just pay to bring items into the community, but also pay to get them out. Reporting for Alaska's Energy Desk in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
After a cold winter, the month of April turned warmer than normal across the state. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brettschneider told editor Annie Feit April broke the string of below normal temperatures that dominated the winter months.
Certainly, March was exceptionally cold here in Alaska. April, we kind of flipped the switch, and so almost every part of the state was above normal. Canada was generally below normal, and Eagle, Alaska, was the only station in the state that was below normal, and just by a hair. So pretty much above normal, coast to coast.
Are there some places that stand out in terms of how much above normal they were?
Well, like has been the case for a long time, the North Slope and then the northwest part of the state were significantly above normal. So like Kotzebue was 11 degrees above normal, Nome 10 degrees above normal. Those are really, really large departures. And those were actually the largest for the entire United States, all of North America, as compared to normal. So exceptional warmth on that part of the state. And for the central and southern part of the state, about 2 to 4 degrees above normal.
And when you're talking about 10 degrees above normal, I mean, like, how shocking is that?
10 degrees is a lot. So, for example, for Kotzebue for April, they should be 13 degrees on average, but they were 24. So 24 is something that you would expect, for around, say, Fairbanks. So it's really, it's essentially moving the climate for hundreds of miles. So it's not unheard of. 10 degrees above normal for months, especially in the cold season. It happens from time to time. In fact, March was 10 degrees below normal for some parts of the state. But we've seen a lot of these the last few years. A lot of places have been 8, 10, 12 degrees above normal for a month. So they start to add up, and it's a troubling sign.
And what about precipitation for April?
Well, April, March, April, May, those are the real dry months in Alaska. And so it's not uncommon to see an entire month with little or no precipitation. And that was certainly the case this month around the state. There were places that didn't see any precipitation or next to none. So speaking of Kotzebue again, they were only had 5/100 of an inch. Up on the North Slope, Barrow, Djokovic had just a trace of precipitation. And the entire state really was below normal.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate and climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tony Gorman in Valdez, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Elizabeth Harbaugh, Rachel Waldholtz, Annie Feit, Casey Grove, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.